Chapter 28. Verse 1. So Isaac sent for Jacob and blessed him. This has to be one of the more remarkable, if not enigmatic, verses in the Torah. Just a few verses earlier, we were told Isaac trembled on learning he had been deceived into giving the blessing of the firstborn to Jacob, the wrong son. But now, Isaac deliberately sought Jacob to again bless him. Has Isaac made peace, virtually overnight, with Jacob's deception and receiving of the birthright blessing meant for Esau? Did Rebekah, whom Isaac adored, convince him what transpired was A, her doing, and B, God's will? We do not know. Verse 1 continued, He instructed him, saying, You shall not take a wife from among the Canaanite women. Rebekah's argument that Jacob must not follow in Esau's footsteps by marrying the local women, Genesis chapter 26, verse 34, was effective. Verse 2. Up, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take a wife there from among the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. Verse 3. May El Shaddai bless you, make you fertile and numerous, so that you become an assembly of peoples. Verse 4. May he grant the blessing of Abraham to you and your offspring, that you may possess the land where you are sojourning, which God assigned to Abraham. Verse 5. Then Isaac sent Jacob off, and he went to Paddan Aram to Laban, the son of Bethuel the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, mother of Jacob and Esau. Verse 6. When Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him off to Paddan Aram to take a wife from there, charging him as he blessed him, You shall not take a wife from among the Canaanite women. Verse 7. And that Jacob had obeyed his father and mother and gone to Paddan Aram. Verse 8. Esau realized that the Canaanite women displeased his father Isaac. Despite his heartbreak over losing the innermost blessing, Esau continued to care about his father and his opinion of him. He wanted to be a dutiful son. On favoring one child over another. The Torah depicts no interaction between Rebekah and Esau. Given that children are very perceptive about their parents' feelings about them, Esau likely realized his mother's preference for Jacob from an early age and reacted by directing his attention and emotions toward his loving father. Rebekah was a kind human being, but being a kind person doesn't always translate into good parenting. The same goes for Isaac, whose preference for Esau was equally apparent, Genesis chapter 25, verse 28. Unfortunately, as is so often the case in parent-child relationships, Jacob wound up repeating the error of favoring one child over the others when he became a parent. It is not easy to avoid repeating parental errors. Our parents are generally the only parenting models we have. To paraphrase the British poet Philip Larkin, they mess you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They give you all the problems they had, and add a few just for you. UCLA psychiatrist Dr. Stephen Marmer has said we would be good parents if we only repeated half our parents' mistakes. Verse 9. So Esau went to Ishmael and took to wife, in addition to the wives he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, son of Abraham, sister of Nebaioth. Apparently seeking to please his father by balancing the mistake he made in marrying the Hittite women, Esau married a daughter of his uncle Ishmael, who had died, Genesis chapter 25, verse 17. Verse 10. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. Verse 11. He came upon a certain place and stopped there for the night, for the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of that place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place. One of the Hebrew terms for God is Ha-Makom, the place. human-God contact. Verse 12. He had a dream. A stairway was set on the ground, and its top reached to the sky. And angels of God were going up and down on it. The Hebrew word for stairway in this verse is used nowhere else in the Bible. But given a similar word in Akkadian, an ancient Semitic language, and in the context of the verse, it is assumed to be stairway, though it is sometimes translated as ladder. We think of angels as residing in heaven and therefore descending to earth. Yet the Torah does not say that the angels were going down and up, but up and down. The reason may be found in the Hebrew word for angel, malach, which means messenger. The angels of the Torah are divine messengers in human form, like the three men who appeared to Abraham in Genesis chapter 18. Therefore, the angels are described here as going up and down. God in our lives. Verse 13, and the Lord was standing at the top of it. An alternate translation is used by the JPS translation of 1917, the New English Bible, the New American Bible, and others. And the Lord stood beside him, that is, beside Jacob, not beside or on top of the stairway. I think this makes more sense. God was close to Jacob in the dream, not far off. With regard to perceiving God in one's life, there are a number of possibilities. One, God directly and unmistakably makes himself known to an individual. Two, we call out to God and then clearly perceive his presence. Three, at some point we decide to recognize God has acted in our life. Four, we believe, but are not certain, God has acted in our life. Five, God has acted in our life, but we are unaware of it. Six, we believe God acts in some people's or even nations' lives, but simply do not know if he has done so in our own. 7. We believe God knows us but does not necessarily intervene in our life. In my view, all of these possibilities are theologically consistent with a Torah view of God. What would not be theologically acceptable is a God who does not know us. That would mean God does not care about us. Verse 13 continued, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham. God's reference to Abraham here is not as Jacob's literal father, but as the founding father of Jacob's religion and people. Verse 13 continued, and the God of Isaac, the ground on which you are lying, I will assign to you and to your offspring. The Torah constantly repeats the centrality of the land of Israel to the faith of Israel and the nation of Israel. God wants at least one place on earth to embody his holy and ethical will. That will become the task of his people, the people descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who came to be known as Jews. The Torah repeatedly warns that if God's people chosen for this task fail, they will be expelled from the land, just as the Canaanites were. It is to be the Holy Land. Verse 14. Your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you and your descendants. Again, the Torah repeats the universal purpose of God's choosing Abraham and his descendants, to be a blessing to all the families of the earth. Essay. Can we expect God to protect us? Verse 15. Remember, I am with you. I will protect you wherever you go. God's promise to Jacob does not mean we can all expect God to protect us. It does not even mean God would protect Jacob from all pain and suffering. As we will see, Jacob suffered a great deal. What God was probably referring to was protecting Jacob from his greatest fears, being harmed by his brother Esau or harmed in a strange land. God, as Maimonides argues, chooses certain people for specific divine roles, and protects them until that role is carried out. Jacob was one such person. Many people believe God will protect them from tragedy, and when it turns out they have not been protected, they lose not only trust in God, but even belief in God's existence. That is one reason it is a bad idea to have such an image of God. Aside from being irrational, it too often leads to disillusionment and the consequent abandonment of faith and religiosity. We cannot expect God to protect us for two reasons. First, that would mean God always intervenes in human affairs and in nature, thereby robbing human beings of freedom and depriving nature of the ability to function according to the laws of nature. In order for God to protect all of us from being hit by a drunk driver, He would have to rob all drivers of the ability to drive while intoxicated, or divert every wayward car from hitting us. In order to protect all of us from all illness, God would have to constantly intervene in nature. And what about protection from non-lethal mishaps? Does divine protection mean we could never fracture a leg? Have our feelings hurt? Where does one draw the line? Second, with a few exceptions chosen by God, if God protects you or me, He will have to protect every decent person in the world. Otherwise, He would be an unfair and capricious God. But many people will respond, they are good people and deserve to be protected. It is surely true that good people deserve to be protected. But if all good people were protected, we would be back to God depriving humans of free will, thereby rendering humans automatons and rendering life meaningless. Moreover, why would anyone expect to be protected given the enormous number of decent people who have not been protected? The foregoing does not mean God never protects us or intervenes in any of our lives. I believe God intervenes in any number of people's lives. We simply cannot expect Him to. What then can we expect from God if not to be protected? I believe we can expect two things. God will honor His promises, and God will provide ultimate justice in an afterlife. As an example of the former, many Jews and Christians see the return of the Jews to their homeland after almost 2,000 years as a fulfillment of divine promises. And as regards the afterlife and its importance, see my essay at Genesis chapter 25, verse 8. My relationship with God does not revolve around expectations of God, other than the two aforementioned exceptions. It revolves around trying to know and do what God expects of me. Verse 15 continued, "And will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." Verse 16, "Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, 'Surely the Lord is present in this place, and I did not know it.'" Verse 17, "Shaken." Clearly, this encounter with God was an awe-inspiring experience. Verse 17, continued, he said, "How awesome is this place! This is none other than the abode of God, and that is the gateway to heaven." Upon awakening from his dream, Jacob drew an understandable but erroneous conclusion. This particular place must be where God dwells on earth. Verse 18. "Early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on the top of it." Verse 19. "He named that site Bethel." Bethel means house of God. Verse 19 continued, "But previously the name of the city had been Luz." Essay on Making Deals with God. Verse 20, "Jacob then made a vow, saying, 'If God remains with me, if He protects me on this journey that I am making, and gives me bread to eat and clothing to wear,'" verse 21, "'and if I return safe to my father's house, the Lord shall be my God.'" Verse 22, "And this stone, which I have set up as a pillar, shall be God's abode. And of all that you give me, I will set aside a tithe for you, To tithe is to give a tenth of one's produce or earnings to one's religion and or to the needy. Jacob's oath raises the issue of people making deals with God, something entirely understandable, but theologically problematic. There are two types of deals people make with God. The first is, God, if you do X for me, I will do Y for you and or for other people. This type of deal is akin to paying a worker for services rendered. If you fix my broken sink, I will pay you, and if you don't, I owe you nothing. In this case, the worker is God, who is rendered essentially a celestial butler. The second type of deal is the reverse. If I do X, you will do Y. A common example would be, God, if I keep your commandments, or if I have the right faith, you will reward me. The commandments example is common among Jews and the faith example among Christians. With regard to the Jewish example, the commandments referred to are usually ritual commandments. Many people believe they will or should be rewarded in this life, with good health, for example, for keeping the commandments between man and God, that is, ritual commandments, such as keeping kosher or observing the Sabbath. This type of deal with God is theologically unsound because the purpose of the laws between man and God is, or should be, encompassed within the practice of the commandment. In the words of the Talmud, the reward for keeping a commandment is the keeping of the commandment. The reward for keeping the Sabbath, for example, is having the Sabbath in one's life. Most people who observe the Sabbath would acknowledge the Sabbath greatly enriches their life. Expecting to be rewarded with good health or long life because one keeps kosher or observes the Sabbath is not only theologically unsound, it reflects poorly on one's religiosity. It means that observing these laws does not give the individual a more rewarding, meaningful, or happier life. One of the most telling things about a religion is whether its adherents are generally happy. If you meet religious people of any religion who radiate unhappiness, you can assume there is something wrong with either their religion or the way they live it. If their religion were all that good, they would surely radiate happiness, not misery. Conversely, when you meet happy religious people, you can assume their religion is impressive. Few Christians believe right practice will bring them rewards in this world, but more than a few believe that with the right faith, they will not contract serious illness or die prematurely. That is the Christian way of making deals with God. Such deals can lead to another insidious consequence. Jews who believe proper practice of the commandments brings health and long life might well assume that a Jew who develops cancer or dies prematurely did not lead a proper religious life. Similarly, Christians who believe proper faith brings health and long life might well assume that a Christian who receives a cancer diagnosis or dies prematurely did not have enough or proper Christian faith. In both cases, this is terribly unfair, even cruel, to the religious person who is suffering from serious illness or prematurely dies. If I knew God, I'd be God, says a medieval Jewish proverb, and we therefore have no way of knowing why there are righteous people who suffer. Finally, such thinking is profoundly irrational. It is difficult to imagine a religious Jew or faithful Christian who does not know of a religious Jew or faithful Christian who has suffered terribly and or died prematurely. Likewise, all of us are aware of irreligious and even evil people who live a long and healthy life. The question remains, did Jacob make such a deal with God? And if he did, was he wrong in doing so? The answer is, we cannot judge Jacob. He was taking his first steps toward an understanding of God. The very fact that he said, God really is in this place and I didn't know, demonstrates this. In this context, what he said was perfectly understandable.